then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, put your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing out.
Greetings from Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 21st, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my voice for freedom, is the rising.
For those of you who are interested, a full transcript of the Boise trial of Edgar Steele is now available at freeedgarsteele.com. That's freeedgar-steele.com. And when you go there, go to the blog section. The transcript is posted there in downloadable sections in PDF format. Next, I'd like to quickly go over an email from James in Montana, bringing up a topic that I've come across every now and then, i.e., in the Northwest Republic, are we going to murder the disabled? I get this every now and then from people who say, oh, Harold, I like what you're saying, and I know you're right, but I saw on the History Channel that the wicked, evil Nazis in Germany murdered all the disabled people. And I have this relative who's in a wheelchair with spina bifida or MS or something of the kind. Your Northwest Republic wouldn't murder my relatives, would you, Harold? Well, the short answer is no. I'm not sure how one proves a negative, of course, just as I don't know how I can prove that certain things did not happen 70 years ago. I don't know how I can prove that people are not going to do something 15 or 20 or 30 years from now. These things that the Jews say about us are lies. They did not happen. Let me give you a little hint as to how to tell when the kikes are lying about the Third Reich. They cite other Jewish so-called historians as authorities and not original source documents. Now, there is one thing that they say about the Germans which happens to be true. They're absolutely anal records keepers and they never throw away anything. It's not completely unknown for some German families and people elsewhere throughout Europe to keep centuries' worth of things like household accounts and trunks in their attic. And these are treasure troves. Historians spend a lot of time trying to get access to these collections. And it's not completely unknown for some little old German lady to be able to go upstairs and pull out some big, huge parchment record book and be able to tell you what her remote ancestors in Nuremberg or wherever spent on beer and schnitzel and a pair of new shoes on February the 16th, 1542, something like that. Basically, I take with a grain of salt anything said about the Third Reich, unless someone can come up with some kind of verifiable and untampered with contemporary record for it. This is one of the reasons why I've always doubted this business about the SA being homosexuals regarding the reasons for the so-called Night of the Long Knives purge. And needless to say, there were no contemporary records or orders or minutes of meetings where any decision was taken to start murdering disabled people in Nazi Germany. I know it's very difficult for most Americans to wrap their minds around the fact that some people will simply make things up in order to hurt other people or in order to gain something for themselves. But it happens all the time. Far more today than it ever did in the past, because liars now have the advantage of the internet and all kinds of technology that they never had before. and they've learned that there is money and power to be had through simply making things up. Don't believe me? Check out the Huffington Post sometime. All I can say is, no, James, we're not going to murder your relatives in wheelchairs. I don't know what else to tell you. Now, I'm going to take a quick paranoia break here. I got an email from a new listener this week who said something to the effect of, "Dear Mr. Covington, I've just discovered your wonderful Radio Free Northwest podcasts, and I'm overjoyed to see that there are so many of them. I'm looking forward to filling my evenings with many long hours of listening pleasure." Yeah, well, the thing about that is, okay, look, I don't want to sound like I myself am succumbing to the kind of paranoia that I have repeatedly urged all of you to avoid, and I don't want to go all mysterious and sinister on you, but suffice it to say that there are some people out there who really, really do not want you listening to these podcasts, and it's starting to get pretty nasty. Basically, they tried the usual crap, and it hasn't worked. Listenership to Radio Free Northwest has started to go up every week for the past month or so, personally I think because of Axis Sally. But for whatever reason, we're beginning to move forward, and for any white nationalist group, that's always a dangerous time. What I recommend to all of you is that you take the time to download as many of the Radio Free Northwest podcasts as you care to, especially those that may have some of your favorite music breaks on them, just in case something happens and they're no longer available. Keep these downloaded audio files on your hard drive. Copy them onto disk or another drive or otherwise make a backup in case you have a crash. You know the old saying about how you never miss the water till the well runs dry, right? Okay, moving right along here. As you know, I've been playing some audio clips over the past few episodes of Radio Free Northwest of people from our past, names that anyone who was involved with the movement ought to know. One of the great leaders of the movement from the 1980s and 1990s, a guy whom I still have some hope may someday get active again, is Louis Beam. This recording is from the 1994 Aryan Nations Congress. It cuts off very abruptly at the end, but there's enough of it to give you an idea of Louis's oratorical style.
"I have been accused of saying nasty things about the government. But saying nasty things about the government is kind of like walking down the hallway of a ship that's been in a storm, where you got all of these sailors puking up their guts, and you find this blob in the hallway, and you say, 'Oh, that's nasty,' and you turn and go the other way. Well, when I talk about the government, that's all I'm doing. They're nasty. I am just telling you what I saw, and I don't like what I saw. So, yes, I talk about them, and I say things about them, because it's the truth. And I do it without compromise or fear. The Bible says, 'Fear no man.' And to the best of my ability, I live by that. And I'm cheered and applauded and patted on the back by literally thousands for the things that I say about the enemies of our race, our folk, and our children. But let me tell you something. As an equal opportunity speaker, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you what the real problem is. Because you need to hear it. The real problem is white folk. It's you. And it's I. Our weaknesses. Our laziness. Our not loving enough. Not caring enough. Has given this land to its enemies. There is no such thing as black power, never has been. There is only white weakness. For where there is white strength, there can be no black power. There is no such thing as Jewish domination. There is only white submissiveness. Refuse to submit, and there is no longer domination. So while our enemies have power over us, is where we are weak. We have given them this power. The problem is white folk. We have become a weak, uncaring, lazy, thoughtless, self-centered, greedy, materialistic people. The results of that is America. Go out the gate and see what the results is. Did you forget? You remember what it was like last time you was home, last time you was downtown, the last time you were in a public school or an institution, or the last time you watched television? You gave us that. And I gave us that. We're all guilty to one degree or another. I include myself in this because there's been times when I could have been stronger. There has been times when I could have gone further. There are times that I could have done more. So I'm responsible too. So I'm not just putting myself into this condemnation because I'm the speaker and I'm supposed to be guilty along with the audience. I'm telling you because it's true. We're too weak. We have become too soft. I tell you, most of us, really and truly, don't deserve, if we're judged by our present day actions and our present day habits and thought system and beliefs and attitudes, we don't deserve the blood we carry in our veins because it came from far better men than ourselves. Now that's the bad news. The good news is you don't have to be that way. It's not in you to be that way. In fact, the opposite is in you. You can be strong. You can be brave. You can win.
I really wish I could get hold of an MP3 of a speech Lewis made at one of Pete Peters' meetings. I think it was right after the Ruby Ridge incident, wherein he greeted the federal agents in the audience by telling them that they were all dogs. If you've ever heard it, you know which one I mean. That was a real rip-snorter, and it's Lewis Beam at his best. I heard it on a cassette tape many years ago, and if anyone can locate an MP3 of that speech and send it to me, I'd be really grateful. I'd love for everybody to hear it. Now, I'm sure some of you have figured out that our own Axis Sally is a big fan of the late David Lane, the man who first uttered the famous 14 words before the jury at his trial in Seattle. Now, this is from an open letter written by David Lane to Timothy McVeigh before his trial as fall guy for the Oklahoma City bombing.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally, and I chose another David Lane piece for this podcast because the recent updates Harold has been posting about the Edgar Steele situation reminded me of the letters David Lane wrote to Timothy McVeigh when he was awaiting his federal trial. I feel they would apply to the Edgar Steele situation even though that trial is over, and who knows, they may contain sound advice some of us may need to take one day. So here are pieces of two letters by David Lane, an open letter to Timothy McVeigh, and P.S. It only gets worse, Tim. I am writing this postscript to my open letter to you in order to further clarify both the details of what you will face in the federal courtroom and what must be shown the jury if you are to have a chance. Above all things, it is necessary to destroy the false illusion of moral authority that power systems, both religious and governmental, have always contrived. Be aware that the media, by any name in any age, exists to control the masses and create that illusion of moral authority for the police powers of church and state. With that in mind, in response to media questions on the specific issues they pick to demonize you, always attack. Mentally, you must prepare for the worst. Do not think that one victory will end it. Double jeopardy laws were subverted long ago by the injustice system and the federal judges. As I told you, I was jeopardized in federal court 3 times in 2 districts for the same offense. If necessary, they will whipsaw you back and forth between state and federal courts and deny it is double jeopardy. They might shuffle you from one federal district to another and then try again. They add or change a motive in the indictment and claim that makes it a new offense, and so another trial is not double jeopardy. They can try you for the act and then for conspiracy to commit the act and claim this is not double jeopardy. They may try you for violating civil rights and then for conspiracy to violate civil rights. You see, they have made a mockery of the plain meaning of the English language, of the words and intent of the Bill of Rights, and of any concept of justice. And still, the media are able to maintain that false illusion of moral authority for the police powers of the government. Let us discuss the jury. You can probably forget talking to the jury about jury nullification rights. The judge will have you gagged before permitting discussion of common law in his star chamber of injustice. Recognize that in the advanced stages of a democracy, a country becomes divided between the parasites at the public trough and the producers whose blood is sucked. Many, if not most, of the producers long ago realized the futility of voting and are no longer on the voting rolls. But the jury will probably be picked from the voter rolls. So they have a built-in bias in favor of the government. That is one reason the government gets a 98% to 99% conviction rate in federal trials. The jury is an enemy, not peers. A federal trial is not like Perry Mason with surprise witnesses or startling testimony. Every iota of evidence and testimony is agreed to in advance by the judge, prosecutor, and so-called defense attorney before the farce begins. The trial is as carefully orchestrated as a Shakespeare play. If there is a hitch in the railroad leading to the defendant's conviction, then the judge calls a recess. He sends the jury out of the room while the train that runs over the defendant is repaired. You have to use deception to sneak messages past the black-robed tyrant on the federal throne and his evil henchmen. If you defend yourself, then short of taking the stand, you get the most latitude for accusations against the government during opening and closing statements. Do not become obsessed with details. Remember, evidence is not the issue. Emotion is the issue. You must make the jury like you and distrust the Federals, if not downright hate them. I wish you the very best. I hope you realize that throwing yourself on the mercy of the court or system is futile. You are dealing with pure, malignant evil, in religious terms, devils incarnate. It appears you are their designated patsy and will be used to deflect attention from their own crimes. Go to the struggle with absolute defiance and accept what they declare in the same manner. A federal is not fit to suck the sweat from your dirty socks. Give them no satisfaction. I am sure that with the strength gained from the certainty of moral rectitude, you will bring honor to 1,000 generations of your ancestors. Having faced the federal inquisitors and having experienced their justice system firsthand, I am inclined to believe there is a good chance that anyone they charge with a political crime is innocent. Furthermore, governments have created incidents in order to advance agendas or enhance police states since governments were first formed. You are about to experience firsthand the farce which the system calls a federal trial, but which in brutal honesty is nothing more than a perjury circus. All federal judges know that the FBI and prosecutors create perjured testimony and present false evidence as standard practice. So, any statement by your so-called defense lawyer that lends credibility to the system is irrefutable evidence that he is a conductor on the railroad that the Federals have put you on. Whatever slight chance you have depends on your putting the government on trial, and a system devil called a lawyer will not do that. So, you have no choice but to defend yourself. When you first express your intention to defend yourself, you will find that the judge and the lawyer assigned to pretend to defend you will argue that you need them in order to cover the details which might allow an appeal. This is pure hogwash. There are no appeals in a political case, just pretense. I must tell you who I am, what I represent, and why I too was a target of the system. My name is David Lane. You may disagree with my politics, but certainly you are aware that a white man who demands a nation or territories for the preservation of his race is the target of the most vicious attacks the system can devise. While political, religious, and economic systems can be destroyed and replaced, the death of a race is eternal. The government under which we live denies the white race not only white nations, but white schools, white neighborhoods, white organizations, and everything necessary for survival as a race. When I discovered the intent of the New World Order crowd to mix and destroy my race, I set out to resist. I have also coined a motto which is now used by the remnant of loyal white people around the world. It is the 14 words, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." So, I am considered to be an enemy of the system. In my opinion, gained the hardest way possible, whatever little chance you have depends on taking your defense directly to the jury and exposing the evils which you have set out to destroy. Best wishes from the gulags of the occupation government, David Lane.
First music break. Sally is also a fan of No Remorse, so here's one of their numbers. This is off a really great YouTube video, which I wish we had the technical capacity to run for you so you could all see it. Maybe one day when we get our general headquarters and a proper studio, we can make Radio Free Northwest a video show and do that kind of thing. This is called Deutschland. Yeah. Something I need to tell you folks, and I might as well just lay it on you. The other day, I received a registered letter at our Seattle box from the Federal Communications Commission informing me that a complaint has been lodged against Radio Free Northwest for, and I quote, failure to provide diverse community coverage, giving all points of view, including those of racial and religious minorities, and threatening to shut us down because we're not complying with the Community Standards Act or some such BS. Anyway, it was about 3 pages long, and I won't get into it. Upshot of it is that publicly accessible white community programming is not allowed even on the internet. You got to be diverse or integrated or whatever the hell. Now, needless to say, we don't have money for an attorney to fight this. And after a lot of thought, I don't see any way, if I want to keep doing this podcast, other than to at least make some attempt to comply with their ridiculous affirmative action and broadcasting law or whatever the hell it is. So from now on, we're going to have on this show at least occasional minority commentators. I don't like this, but it seems that we have no choice. This is Dries Washington, and I's coming to you niggas on this here Radio Free Northwest. That fat motherfucker Hal Cunningham done come up to me in the bus station in Seattle, and he said, Dries, I needs to get me some diversity on my internet radio show. And I say, yeah, you give me a bottle of Muscatel and I'll diversify your ass. Now, Hal tell me I's supposed to be providing the African-American viewpoint on the news of the day. I told him I don't have no viewpoint, African-American or otherwise, because I can't see shit lying in the gutter drunk out of my black ass. But Hal said, that's all right. Just say whatever come to my mind. What come to my mind is, why is that jive-ass nigga Barack Obama been negotiating with all them white motherfuckers in Congress about raising the debt ceiling so he can borrow more money? Well, shit, nigga, why you want to go buying money for anyway? You need money, you just get your nine, go down on K Street and rip off a liquor store like the other niggas do. Are you black? You from Chicago? You ought to know that. Oh, you would know that, but you ain't even a real nigga anyway. Like the Reverend Al said, you does not have the authentic African-American experience. Are you daddy some Kunta Kinte African nigga and your mama some hippie hoe white bitch who's probably so fucked up from smoking all that Maui Wowie she didn't know what she was fucking that night? Now you president, you think you be the big boss nigga, but you ain't shit, boy. Should have sent your high yellow red bone ass back to Africa where you get eat up by crocodiles or swallowed by one of them big ass snakes is what? Okay, fool, I done said what was on my mind. Now where my bottle of wine?
Stupid monkey.
Okay, that's enough of that. More than enough. Time now for a little recap here. We're going to go over a subject we've gone over before, but it's come up again. And as I've said before, we have to do a lot of spaced repetition on this show. My talk about professionalizing the party and establishing a general headquarters has led to more internal discussions on compounds and headquarters buildings and, of course, the endless dirge of post-mortems on what was wrong and what went wrong with Kale and Franklin Road and at Aryan Nations and Glenn Miller's Farm and Hillsboro and so forth and so on. Anyway, so let's talk about the whole concept of headquarters for a while. Now, this email is from Frank, who lives in New Jersey, New York, someplace back east. I don't know exactly where. Like so many of our people, I only know him as an email address. I think I used to have a physical address on him, but he never responded, so I dropped him. Anyway, Frank says, Dear HAC, here it is, as short and clear and simple as I can make it. First, as everyone knows by now, the world is facing the biggest economic disaster ever. This is a magnificent opportunity to lead white people to something much better than we have today. You have the right idea, a homeland for whites in the Northwest, but how are you going to get them there? Zionists had the same problem finding immigrants for Israel before World War II. It took a disaster to get things going. Well, a disaster is on the way now. If you can provide a center for unemployed whites to rally where they can obtain food, clothing, shelter, and a new start with a new trade, occupation, or profession, you will be a great benefactor of your race. I'd hope to do something like that with Dr. Pierce's headquarters in West Virginia. a center for whites who could learn a trade, farm the land, enjoy recreation while they do it. Just as an aside, Frank, did you ever actually speak to him about that? I bet he really loved that idea. Anyway, getting back to Frank's email, you probably never heard of Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement. For a while, anyway, she owned a farm in New Jersey where the homeless could go and support themselves while they sobered up, recovered, learned a job, whatever. It would be easy to start. Just find one excellent plumber, carpenter, mason, electrician, farmer, welder, etc. Pay that man to train to perfection just two other men. Then have each of those two men train two other men, and so on and so on. Soon you would have a workforce that could build and sustain a community. A white man's development center. A place where hard-pressed whites could come for refuge and a new start. If you could do this, you would be another Moses to your people. I know, easier said than done, but it has to start somewhere, no matter how small. I'm 75 years old, still vigorous, but my time's short. I could teach boxing, typing, shorthand, clerical procedure, study techniques. Others could do much more. I'm retired, so I could work for free. So could other retirees. No parasites. Only those willing to work, cooperate, contribute, and learn allowed in. Bottom line, probably few people will move to the Northwest on their own initiative. But if you can offer them an inducement like a safe haven, food, clothing, shelter, job training, recreation, fellowship, community, it might be easier to attract them. Start small, grow big. Great honor to you for your work on behalf of our race. Okay, Frank, don't get me wrong here, and don't any of you get me wrong at all. Almost every week, I get people emailing me with ideas and comments that are damn good ideas and things that they're right, the Northwest Front really should be doing. And I know it sounds like more often than not I'm poo-pooing these people in some way. I'm not, really. But they just don't seem to understand that none of what I say or they say or anybody says is any good at all unless they turn off their computers, get up from behind the keyboard, and actually do all this stuff. That's what's not happening yet. We have these great discussions, and we make all these great plans behind the keyboard at night, with or without the help of a six-pack. Then we turn off the computer and go to bed and get up in the morning and do the same thing again that night. And it just goes on and on and on for years. No actual physical action is ever taken. Now, other people aren't like that. Niggers are now using Facebook and Twitter to bring together flash mobs of hundreds of coons to attack whites and rob stores and trash shopping malls. Arabs use Facebook and Twitter to bring together tens and hundreds of thousands of people in public squares to literally face down the government tanks. Now, when are we going to see a million white people standing on the Ellipse and in Lafayette Park brought together by Facebook and Twitter demanding that Obama step down immediately and flee the country? Politicians use the internet to raise millions of dollars, and when I so much as mention that fact in passing, I get accused of being some kind of money-grubbing swindler. True, Frank, there are millions of unemployed white people right now living in their cars all over the country because they've lost their jobs to India or China and because they've had their homes foreclosed on. The Northwest should be providing soup kitchens and various goods and services for white people that the system no longer can or will provide. There is no way to win hearts and minds better than feeding a man's family and giving him work to do. The entire Pacific Northwest should be a beacon of hope by now for the white race on this continent. Now, Frank's idea of what I suppose you might call white soup kitchens is, in fact, a damn good idea. It's actually how Hamas got started in Palestine, as an Islamic welfare agency that supplied and still supplies jobs and medical care and food and dignity to the Palestinians where the Israelis would not. We would be making the Pacific Northwest that beacon of hope right now for white people that would lead to independence. I agree, Frank, 100%. Now, all we need is a wealthy, propertied man who thinks more of his race than he does of his bank balance and who is willing to give us some land in an accessible area, not way, way, way out in the boonies, where people can actually get to it without having to hire a Sherpa guide. That land has to be sufficiently developed to have at least a few trailers and electricity on it so we can function. And then we need our 4,000 listeners per week out there to start kicking in that $10 a month I mentioned a few podcasts ago so that we'll have the ability to develop this place and pay at least room and board for a staff. Unfortunately, we don't have those things. As nearly as I can determine, none of our listeners and associates are sufficiently wealthy anymore to actually own any land anywhere, which is not a movement thing. It's a white thing. Now, back in the day, the Klan and the citizens' councils in the South always had supporters who owned land for rallies and meeting halls and clavern halls and such. Now, in those days, there was still some wealth left in white hands. In those days, there was still an independent white business community. Today, the Chamber of Commerce in every town is an arm of the Republican Party and the corporations. And almost everybody works for a paycheck, either from a corporation if they're a Republican or from the government if they're a Democrat. The only property most white people own at all nowadays is a McMansion sitting on a third of an acre in some development. And of course, a lot of folks don't even own that anymore. These days, one of the reasons that white men and women seem to wake up and become racially conscious in the first place is because their money is hit first, and they lose everything that they have to Obama's depression. They're living in their cars, and they see Mexican illegals rolling by in huge SUVs with the salsa music blaring down the street. Now, if one of you guys has a McMansion somewhere in the Northwest you'd like to donate for our general headquarters, or for a soup kitchen or a white job training center, by all means, get in touch. I'll take that as well. And of course, the second problem with building a center like Frank describes is that I can't get our 4,000 weekly listeners to go beyond listening, at least not many of them. $10 a month from each of them would be $40,000 a month. We could run a couple of lighthouse-like facilities for unemployed white people on that. But this whole Northwest thing so far isn't something people do. It's a form of entertainment, at least in most of your minds. And so long as that condition prevails, no headquarters, no help for poor white families, no nothing. Yes, it's changing. There are a tiny trickle of racial migrants actually starting to come here. A few who are willing to go first. There will be a tipping point once we get at least a little bit of a safety net set up. There will be more as the word gets out all throughout the movement and throughout the racially conscious, whatever you want to call this thing we've got on the internet and elsewhere, that there is a place that white people can go and actually meet real people, not just email addresses. White Americans won't go first or to take any risks anymore. But they'll jump on a bandwagon once they see that someone's already gone first and done all the heavy lifting. And we have to accept that that's the way we are. We might yet be able to get something like Frank's White Soup Kitchen Project going, but we don't have enough people yet who are willing to go first, to come here off their own bat, at their own expense, without a safety net, and who are willing to do the heavy lifting so that we can start building the bandwagon, if you'll excuse my mixed metaphors. I mentioned money a couple of weeks ago on one of these podcasts, and my God, you would have thought I'd pissed in the punch bowl. You should have heard the screams and curses all over the internet. Harold is a con man! Harold is a con man! He actually used the forbidden word, dues. Yeah! Con man, it's all happening again like it did in Hillsborough, blah, 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 blah. Harold is asking for money to do things with, and we can't have that now, can we? Of course, I wasn't actually appealing for money, if you will listen to that podcast. I was simply discussing the topic of movement finance, such as it is, and I mentioned the fact that, yeah, a legal political movement is going to need money to operate on. What can I tell you, guys? That's the way it is out here in the real world. Now, Frank, you said you were 75. That puts you born in, what, 1936? You're probably too young to remember the first Depression, but I'm sure you remember the days when white people actually did things. Now, you would have been about 20 years old when they first started sitting down in their living rooms every night in front of the flickering television screen and the rotting of the minds started. Sorry, Frank. Yours is a great idea, and like so much else, it would work. But white people just won't do things anymore. I wish it was different. Second music break. Something a little bit more on the easy listening line. This is William Byrd, the Agnes Dei from A Mass for Five Voices.
On your stay,
Okay, remember I said that my July 7th podcast will be my final canned answer on the subject of character? Well, so it will be, in the sense of the character, or lack thereof, of the goat dancers. But unfortunately, the character of our race as a whole is something that we're going to have to be talking about for a long time. Now, this isn't just me. You heard earlier in the podcast that Lewis Beam was talking about the white racial character 17 years ago. Of course, before we can figure out how to make us stop being what we are, we have to figure out why we are what we are in the first place and how we got that way. But I don't want this to turn into one of these endless do-nothing post-mortems, these litanies of nothing but bitch, bitch, moan, moan, whine, whine, oh, how horrible it all is, and then we turn off the computer and do it all again tomorrow. Suffice it to say that the Jews have turned us into worms. Nor will I go on and on about how we have to keep on sifting and sifting for the small minority of people who have not been spiritually destroyed. Now, that goes without saying, and in any case, I've said it all before. What we're going to have to start thinking about is how we can initiate some kind of serious moral and spiritual change in ourselves and in others. Okay, let's try and boil this down to the very basics. What is the practical nature of the problem? The problem is that even racially aware white people will not physically do much of anything at all in order to change the situation. Okay, why won't they do anything? Now, the standard answer is cowardice, i.e., the big bad policeman will hurt them if they try to change anything. Well, that's certainly a large part of it. Most white males these days aren't white, they're yellow in that sense. But the situation is more complex than that. Now sure, pure and simple fear of the big bad policeman and torture and buggery in prison by niggers accounts for a lot of the inaction, but not always and not all of it. Accepting that physical cowardice is a part of it, there are other factors in play. One is laziness. White Americans are bred from birth to always take the line of least resistance. All these appliances our grandparents and parents were so proud of, like washers and dryers and vacuum cleaners and dishwashers, on up to automatic car washes and garage door openers and rider lawnmowers and power tools. All of these are essentially labor-saving devices so that white people no longer have to bend and stoop and strain their muscles and apply what used to be called elbow grease to anything. White males no longer want to do any heavy lifting in any sense of the term. White Americans will no longer work in the fields in agricultural labor like family farmers and hundreds of generations of European peasants did, like the Okies of the 1930s used to do. And increasingly, in most parts of the country, we're seeing fewer and fewer white males working with their hands on roadworks or construction sites. I constantly get newcomers telling me how astounded they were to drive by a road repair site or go into a fast food restaurant here in the Northwest and see nothing but white employees. Today's white boy is raised in front of a TV and a computer screen with a mouse in his hand, and he expects to go to college and get some kind of bullshit qualification and spend the rest of his days wearing a pastel shirt and a tie, sitting in a cubicle and tapping on a keyboard all day before he comes home at night to tap on a keyboard over at Stormfront or VNN. Okay, I won't belabor the point, which has been made many, many times before, but I think a lot of the recalcitrance to come home to the Northwest on the part of white boys who know damned well that it's what they should be doing is due to their reluctance to do all the physical stuff, the hefting and toting and the packing things and the just plain physical effort of it all. That's shameful, but it's a real factor, and we need to acknowledge it and find some way to overcome it. Also, there are other kinds of fear in play besides fear that the big bad policeman might hurt us. There is fear of loss of money and personal possessions, since the Jews have raised us to be completely materialistic. Now remember, we've been taught all our lives to believe that anyone who does not have money and all of the visible trappings of money is a quote-unquote loser, and that the one thing you must never be in this society is a loser. If for no other reason than if you have no money, you won't have any access to medical care when you get older. Oh, and you mustn't be sick or old either. Now, there's fear of social disapproval, of leaving the herd, and that's why so many white people won't come home until they know that there's another herd here for them to join. Americans will leap onto a bandwagon, but they won't help build it, and they won't give it a push to get it rolling. Now, there is the internet factor. Mostly white males, but more and more women as well, have found a substitute for action in the internet that gives them a false feeling of accomplishment and an inflated sense of self-esteem. Most of them honestly believe that by making posts to the internet, especially to groups like Stormfront and VNN, they are in some way part of a big revolution or a movement, and that therefore they're doing their duty, and there's no need for all that risk and inconvenience which is entailed in coming home. They're not part of anything, of course, since no real-world action of any kind is resulting from our internet presence. But I think most white people either don't get that, at least not at first, or they don't want to think about it. That's another aspect of our character problem, our unwillingness to think about and deal with subjects that cause us pain. In the old days, white children, especially boys, were raised to be strong, to show courage in the face of pain and overcome it. They were used to receiving physical blows and correction from their parents. I saw on Drudge the other day where another woman, presumably white, was arrested in New Jersey, I think, for spanking her child. I think this may be one of the reasons for the apparent taboo on my citing individual instances of weak character, corruption, and wrongdoing among those who claim to speak for the white resistance movement. There is a need in so many of our people to believe. And when they find out that they've trusted people who are not worthy of that trust, it causes pain. And white kids are raised from birth these days to run away from pain, to avoid it rather than to confront it and overcome it. Okay, this is leading up to another topic, and that is the old idea, which I think more and more may have some merit, that we should have had sense enough to deal with the character issue first, many years ago, through creating an actual white man's religion. I have several times stated that if I ever had it to do all over again, I might go that route. Now, it's obviously too late for me to reinvent myself as the Prophet Harold, complete with flowing robes and beard down to my waist, but there is something I think I'd better confess to you guys now so as to remove any temptation later on for me to actually do it. And I admit that over the past couple of years, the temptation has been getting stronger. Now, you all know I'm a passable writer, and I have a flair for history. Now, I could probably drum up a pretty good holy book, if only a short one. Hey, it's been done before. Joseph Smith did it. L. Ron Hubbard did it. I could probably do a pretty good King James Bible or Koran or Norse saga knockoff, maybe with Shakespearean iambic pentameter or something like that. Now, the idea that I've been toying with in my brain is, suppose that I or someone else were to mysteriously, quote-unquote, discover a mystical revelation to the children of the sun or something, laying out a basic ethical code for modern white nationalists, but gussied up in all kinds of highfalutin language and mystical symbolism, blah, blah, blah. Instead of the simple elegance of Marcus Aurelius, whose philosophy really is all we need, and which is as old as Christianity, and whom 99% of so-called white nationalists have no idea ever existed, and are probably incapable of understanding so much as 10% of what he wrote. Anyway, suppose I were to load up this holy book with all kinds of occult and supernatural mumbo-jumbo, and I'm pretty good on that stuff as well. You know, the kind of thing that Americans will eat like candy while ignoring the genuine, old-fashioned, time-tested ethics of our race. For example, maybe I could make it a revelation from space aliens to the white race. I mean, that works. Starship Ruthie has about 1,000 people living in caves and bunkers up in Montana someplace waiting for the mothership to descend. And my cult wouldn't demand that anybody drink any Kool-Aid or commit suicide. It would tell white people, on the contrary, how they should live. Of course, we already know that, but since we have apparently decided that we don't need the old ways of our ancestors anymore, or they're just too hard, or else we just simply don't care to know about anything that happened before we were born, perhaps if I simply repackaged all the essentials in New Age space alien techno crap, maybe baby would take his medicine then. Americans seem to want what H.L. Mencken called hokum and Will Rogers called bunkum. Maybe we should give it to them. So then I arrange for this mysterious revelation to magically appear on the internet on a website put up through untraceable proxy servers or some such BS. Maybe publish it on print per order under the name of Eric the Blood Prophet or some crap like that and see what happens. Of course, anything like that, the usual suspects would immediately start screaming that I wrote it, just like these jackasses still claim that I wrote that brief history of the white nationalist movement, which they find so inconvenient because it can't be refuted. Now, that's one reason that I always figured I better not really try to do anything like that. I didn't write the brief history, but the paranoia surrounding that document gave me a taste of what would happen if a mysterious divine revelation to the white folks were to suddenly appear, and it seemed to be halfway well written. I mean, let's face it, who the hell else in this wee little movement of ours even knows what iambic pentameter is, let alone can write content in it? But still, this leaves us with the serious problem that the people we urgently need to get their act together, white people, especially young white people, are, well, not to put too fine a point on it, a bunch of hopeless doofuses and dipshits. It's not a lack of education or facts that's the problem. There is more than enough fine racial and political material available in both book and internet form to convince anybody on earth with an open mind that we're right. The problem is our weak character, which prevents white people from acting on our knowledge once we become racially aware. So, what the hell do we do about that? Now, if we won't look back to our own ancestors, would we buy some kind of 21st century cyber cult, obey it, and get our act together? In other words, would this new thingummy I'm talking about finally do the trick and make white boys actually do something? If so, what should be in this new religion of ours, do you think? Now, bear in mind what the ultimate goal is. It's to get white people to turn off the computer, stand up, and actually physically do something. Preferably something legal and beneficial like Northwest Migration, but just getting them to do almost anything instead of tap about it on a computer keyboard will be a form of success. So what do you think a new white, well, in deference to our CI comrades and our Odinists and whatnot, I won't use the word religion, but let's say ethical code. What do you think a new white ethical code should look like? We won't bother with the aliens for the time being. I'm not going to try the mysteriously appearing holy book trick since I just gave myself away, but I say again, the problem itself still remains. How do we solve it? Okay, we seem to have some British history fanatics on our list, and we just can't seem to get away from the Jacobites. I won't go into a long blow-by-blow recap of a debate I've been having with one of our European comrades, but in order to placate him and make his point that the Jacobites were not just a Scottish phenomenon, I'm going to play an Irish Jacobite song for you for our third music break. This is one called The Outlawed Rapparee. Long, complex story short, as always. When James II invaded Ireland in 1690 and had all the to-do about the Battle of the Boyne and the Siege of Derry and blah, 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 and finally he was defeated and he left Ireland. He left behind a lot of demobbed soldiers from his army, which is always a bad idea. And a lot of these guys basically went out into the woods and the mountains and the bogs of Ireland and became more or less outlaws, some of the first highwaymen. And they were called Rapparees, which is a contraction for an Irish word meaning king's men, since they were mostly the former soldiers of King James. Anyway, like I said, this one's called The Outlawed Rapparee, and this is Makeham and Clancy.
A bunch of fellas in Ireland one time who were outlawed by the British, and they went out into the hills. They were called Rapparees, and they did great work. They used to take money off the rich fellas, and they'd give it to poor fellas like us. It's called The Outlawed Rapparee.
My spurs are rusted, my coat is rent, my plume is damp with rain, and the thistledown and the barley beers are thick on my horse's mane. But my rifle's as bright as my sweetheart's eyes, my arm is strong and free. What care have I for your king or lost? I'm an outlawed rapparee. Lift your glasses, friends, with mine, and give your hand to me. I'm England's foe, I'm Ireland's friend, I'm an outlawed rapparee. The mountain cavern is my home, I open the crystal air, and my bed of light
limestone island rift and the brown geese smelling fair. The George or William only sent his troops to burn our loot. We'll meet them up on equal ground and we'll fight them foot to foot. Steel and shot, a bloody warfare we must wage, or the gibbet be our lot. Hurrah, this war is welcome won, the hunted outlaw knows he steps unto his country's love for the corpses of his foes. Your glasses, friends, with mine, give your hand to me. I'm England's boy, I'm Ireland's friend, I'm an outlaw robbery.
I'll be honest with you, there are not very many people out there whom I genuinely and seriously listen to. Surprise, surprise. And yet the other day I had an exchange with one of those comrades that did give me pause. Now, this person said some things and made some criticisms which I have to admit have some validity to them. A lot of validity, in fact, and in all fairness I should share these with a group. Unfortunately, the group includes all the SPLC and FBI monitors, and so I can't have the kind of open discussion here that I would like. But the upshot of it is this. This comrade, who has been in a position to observe things for some time now, is of the opinion that I need to leave the internet and at least semi-retire to concentrate on writing and not much else. He says, with a little effort and print-per-order publishing, I should be able to earn enough through sales of my books to keep body and soul together, given the fact that my personal needs are very modest. His reason is simple. He says, I'm giving it what is clearly my best effort, and it's just not working. He tells me flat out that I'm spending entirely too much time sitting behind a computer keyboard all day on some days, instead of exercising and doing things in the real world. He tells me flat out that after almost 10 years, it should be obvious that the small return I'm getting on my efforts simply does not justify the input and effort I'm making, and it's pretty clear that it's not going to get any better. Now, I find it kind of difficult to argue with him. I said to him, oh, wait, let me guess, we got to wait until things get bad enough, right? Now, how many years have we both been hearing that? And he replied, no, that's where we were wrong. Things are finally getting bad, and these people still aren't doing anything. Look at all the things that have happened just since November 2008. There should have been more of a public reaction by now. Look at what you've been doing for the past 10 years. You should have gotten more of a response by now. I should mention, by the way, that this comrade is not bitter or angry or sullen about it. He's very brisk and practical, and he's genuinely offering me the best advice he can under the circumstances. Now, he is of two minds even about Radio Free Northwest. He said to me, okay, Harold, it's a good show and I like listening to you, but is it really producing anything besides more internet? Now, that was always my core objection to the internet, that it produces nothing but more internet. And yet, not always. I say again, possibly one of the most important points I've ever made, in fact, that the problem is not the internet. The problem is us. Other races and groups, including Chicago niggers and Arabs and American politicians, are now using the internet to produce real-world activity and real-world results. Now, I responded to this comrade with that comment, and he said, and I quote, oh, yes, I know, and that's one of the worst indictments of the racially conscious white community, the fact that we have been handed this magnificent propaganda tool, the only mass media we've ever had access to, and for 15 years now we have completely failed to make any serious use of it, while others have. For Christ's sake, Harold, after 15 years, even niggers have finally learned to use the Internet. We haven't. He goes on, and again I quote directly from an email here, "Harold, at some point you are going to have to hang it up. You are going to have to accept that these people are simply useless, that they are hopeless losers and they will never change. And you're going to have to start settling into a kind of semi-retired mode so that you can write as much as you can before your health problems catch up with you. It simply doesn't make sense to continue baiting the FBI and other authority figures at your age. If they will go to the lengths of fabricating a quasi-legal frame-up against Edgar Steele at age 65, what have they got in store for you, do you think?" And by the way, I'll give you guys a little tidbit here. Whenever two old movement hands get together, when they refer to quote-unquote these people, guess what people they're talking about? You. Now, once again, I'm really hampered here by my inability to conduct a full and honest discussion because of all the little pitchers with big ears who are listening, so I have to restrict myself to a few general comments. First off, yes, it is true that I spend most of my day on the Internet or on the computer in one form or another, including the time when I need to be out walking to try and bring down my murderous malignant hypertension. I have to, because virtually everything I need to do depends in some way on a functioning personal computer. I even write mostly on the computer, although recently I've taken to trying to compose the fifth Northwest novel, Freedom's Sons, in longhand, specifically to get me away from the keyboard and at least sitting in front of a proper desk with a pen in my hand for a while. And that's proven to be very hard. My hand cramps up after a couple of sentences, and my writing is atrocious. While I've been banging on the keyboard all these years, I think my hand has forgotten how to actually write. The reason I spend most of my time on the computer is because whether I like it or not, and I don't, this is the weapon that we have been given. It is the only medium of mass communication which is open to us. You have to play the hand you're dealt. 222 years ago, on July the 14th, 1789, a mob of people in Paris stormed the fortress of the Bastille, where the old regime kept its political prisoners, including, among others, the Marquis de Sade. The way that happened was that there was an open-air market or something of the kind in front of the fortress, and a young man named Camille Desmoulins got up on a table and began speaking to the crowd, haranguing them about the king's injustice, and he was such a fiery and persuasive orator that he was able to incite a mob of people to storm a castle with their bare hands. Now, it's right that the French to this day celebrate Bastille Day as a national holiday. I would love to be that young man jumping up on that table, inciting the mob to storm the Bastille. I would. But guys, let's be honest, it ain't happening. That was then, and this is now. It is an unfortunate fact that, realistically speaking, what good one man can do these days pretty much has to be done with a computer keyboard, until such time as you yourselves change. I can't conjure up a Bastille-storming mob out of nowhere. Eventually, I or someone will be able to conjure up that mob using Facebook and Twitter, like the Arabs did earlier this year. But until you yourselves change, that time is nowhere in the future. Now, I'm sorry if you guys think all these discussions we've been having about character are boring, and I'm sorry if you don't want to hear it, as some of you keep telling me, but you have to hear it. We are going to continue these discussions on here about the real problem, i.e., what is wrong with us. I am going to continue with these discussions that you don't want to hear, because it is my duty to do so and make you hear it, whether you want to or not. It is your duty to pack that moving van, to come here to the homeland where you are supposed to be, and to participate in securing the existence of our people and the future for white children. When you guys decide to do your duty, then I won't have to do mine. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.